Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Guys, welcome back to Talk Magic. It is episode 4, and I am here with the frankly super amazing Mr. Mark Oberon. Mark, how you doing, mate?
Great, thank you, Craig.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. You know I respect the hell out of you, and I think you're an amazing performer, an amazing guy. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And, you know, when I decided to put the show together, you were one of the very first people that I wanted to interview because, and we were talking about this off camera, but I'm going to say it again now for everybody to hear. You have had the career that most people dream about. You know, you've performed all over the world. You've performed on TV. You've won more championships than I could possibly even count. You've created some of the most popular magic tricks over the last few years. You've done so much and you've got so much to share to the magic community that frankly, as an interviewer and someone interviewing you, I don't really know where to start. You've done so much.
Well, thank you. I don't know how to answer that. I'm just a little bit embarrassed, but also quite flattered. Thank you.
Well, let's start at the very beginning, Mark. How did you get into magic? Was it the typical, I got a Paul Daniels set or
small child thoroughly believing in magic and wanting to be a magician. And you know, in fact, I can even remember at a children's party, a magician doing a miser's dream. And I completely believed that he was pulling money out of thin air. And then he pointed to my father and said, I've just made a coin appear in your top pocket. You know, give it to your son later. And so after the show, I said, is it there? And he gave me the coin, you know, and I just thought this was incredible. So I absolutely believed in magic and I wanted to be a magician. And then I suppose it's when you find out that Santa Claus doesn't exist, it's a little bit of a disappointment. But at the same time, you can then still enjoy other people believing in Santa Claus, like my younger brothers. So it's a different experience of, you know, sort of creating the wonder for others is almost as good, possibly better, but just different. And when I was about, I don't know, in primary school, a school teacher, Mr. Geary, was an amateur magician, and he did a show for us, and he had the die box, which I just thought was incredible, the sliding die box, and he did lots of things. It was just the most wonderful experience. And afterwards, I'd got the Paul Daniels magic set and a few bits and bobs and some plastic bits. And I knew a couple of, you know, a few tricks. And I said to him, you know, I really, really want to be a magician. And he gave me some magazines from the Supreme Magic Company, the Magigram. And these were, you know, copies back from early 1970s. And they were full of tricks that you could order through the post. And there was articles on magic. And I treasured these things. And it's just wonderful. And then I started to subscribe to the magazine and started to get the Magigram every month. And I started to purchase a few things. And he asked if I'd like to do a show for the class. So I did a little show. And I remember buying eggs from mouth, you know, you know, you get this thing and it's half a ping pong ball that's painted pink on the inside. And you know, it's got to palm an egg. But my hands were too small to palm an egg. So my mother, who worked for the police at the time, she gave me these policeman's gloves, which were massive, great big white gloves. And I had this thing about white gloves because I thought the magician's thing, he's wearing these white gloves. So I was like a little boy with these massive, great big white gloves on that enabled me to hide this egg and do eggs from mouth. And so that I'd be around, I don't know, maybe I'd be 8 or 9 around that time. And then when I was 12, I was in a magic shop called the Magic Emporium in Nottingham on Mansfield Road. And I met a magician called David Charles, who would be, he would be maybe in his mid to late 20s, and he was a manipulator, and he did the rings and he did the dancing cane and thimbles, and I just thought this chap was, you know, I just hero worshipped this guy. And he started to teach me magic from when I was between 12 and 16. And my mother would drive me to his house. And we're by this time, we were a one parent family, three children, very poor. And my mother would pay him £1.50 for him to teach me magic. And, you know, it was £1.50 an hour, but he always used to teach me for about 3 hours and still just charged her £1.50. And he, you know, and he taught me, and we're still friends to this day. And, you know, yeah. And then he put me into the, he got me to enter the Magic Circle Young Magician of the Year when I was about 16, which I did. And I came third. And it was the year that Noel Britton, the president of the Magic Circle, he was second. And in first place was Andrew O'Connor, who, you know, who was the guy that created Objective Productions and, you know, all the Darren Brown shows and all that. So he was in first place. So, yeah, that was, so actually that's the longest answer I've ever given to anybody who's ever asked me how I got into magic.
Well, you know what? It's really interesting to see. And, you know, that you started so young, and, you know, I didn't know that you'd entered the Young Magician, the Magic Circle Young Magician, when you were 16. Was it something that when you, because obviously at 16 you finish education or you go to further education, when did you go straight into being a working professional, or did that happen after a while?
No, I did actually, because I suppose I had no interest in school in my teens, and, you know, I was bordering on being a problem child, actually. You know, that they would just put me to one side on a desk on my own because I was a bit of a disruptive influence, because I'd be doing Find the Lady and showing people tricks, and, you know, I was a bit, so they sort of like sidelined me, and I understand why they'd do that, so that other children could concentrate. And, you know, so I didn't do any exams or anything. I left school at 16, and when I was 17, I went, or 17, maybe, yeah, when I was 17, I went to Corfu, and I was working for Warner's Holidays. It was a company at that time, they called it Nova, and it was like being a Butlin's red coat. So I was calling bingo. You had to be able to do all sorts, everything on to do with entertainment, but you had to have an act. So I got it on the strength of my act, and yeah, so that was my first thing. And then I did a couple of years of that kind of thing. And then I was really into another side of magic, which I always, I like, what can you call it? Spacey, dark, trippy imagery. And so yeah. I remember reading a book called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which was quite a classic, and it's about this group of people who travel around on this bus taking LSD and painting their faces up with glow-in-the-dark colors, and they'd have these acid parties where they would all be glowing in the dark with ultraviolet lights. I remember thinking, wow, like, and just sort of linking that kind of thing with magic and thinking, what would magic look like if it was more trippy, I suppose. And I got this, back to the white gloves from the, I found these gloves glowed under ultraviolet light, and I had a dancing cane, and I had it painted like a spiral in different colored ultraviolet colors. And I found that with the ultraviolet light doing the dancing cane and spinning it, you got like a trail of colors, and, you know, and so, and I showed this to my friends, and they were, whoa, you know, it was a real party trick to do the switch off all the lights and this sort of thing. And I would do things like have a glow in the dark snake. Right. And I've got these movements so that I could move the snake and you make it really look snake like. And if you can't see the person, you can't. So, I remember with friends going out into a forest and charging up. It was a luminous one, not an ultra. So it was charging up on the headlights of the car, and then switching off the car lights and having strange music on in the car, and walking around the side of the car with this glowing snake. So my friends in the car were just sort of seeing this glowing snake traveling around the car. And so I'm digressing a little bit, but yeah, so I remember doing this little show. I'd probably be about maybe 20. And I did a normal show with the, you know, the linking rings, the chop cup, and a pretty sort of standard thing. And then I said, oh, now I'd like to show you something else. And I did the Dancing Cane, and people were really like amazed by it. So then I started thinking, oh, I need more of this glow in the dark stuff. And I just kept adding to it. I did the Dancing Ring on Rope, changed that into UV. And then when I was about 21, there was an in the stage newspaper for actors and entertainers, there was an advert looking for bizarre acts to work in discotheques. And I went along to it, and it was Alan Whitehead, and he was the drummer in the band Marmalade, you know, pretty famous from the 60s. And he was an agent who was putting strange acts together. If it was kind of sexy, just weird, or abstract, just something that would just make them go, what? They were putting acts like that into discotheques. And so I formed an act, and he started to use me in, you know, put me in the nightclubs. And yeah, so it was great. In fact, his son, Curtis Whitehead, is now a magician, and we're friends to this day. So yeah.
That's awesome. I was just going to say, your UV act, you became very famous for that UV act. I remember, I think it might have been an IBM convention the first time I saw that. And I was just blown away. I'd never seen anything like it before. But you do so much other stuff. I mean, is this what I'm trying to say is, these days, a lot of people, if they're a close-up magician, they just do a close-up act. If they're a stage magician, they just do a stage act. It's very decompartmentalized. But you do so much. I mean, you've got your gold act from, and I want to talk about that. You've got your UV act. You've got all your phenomenal close-up stuff. You do mentalism. You know, have you found it difficult to, like, do so much? Is there one thing that you've put all of the effort in? How have you managed to create and perform so many different things over the years?
Well, I think often it's a case of necessity being the mother of invention. So when I had the UV act, that actually, you know, I made a pretty good living all throughout my 20s and right through my 30s as well, just with the UV act. And it was only when I was late 30s, sort of 40-ish, that what tended to happen was, well, in fact, it was coming the way the rave scene started coming along. And that kind of, in a way, raves in, you know, in the 90s, that they wanted to keep the music flowing. So they didn't like the idea of it stops and then there's an act that everybody watches. They wanted, like, things here and things there, and the night mustn't stop for anything. It must just flow along. And so DJs started to become the big stars, and any kind of act in a nightclub was you know, sort of sidelined a little bit. So because the nightclub scene changed, the opportunities to perform in a nightclub environment just got less and less. And of course, I was also doing a little bit of corporate, but not enough to support me. So I was looking for other things, and I started to get into close-up magic. And when I would do my UV show in a corporate situation, I would offer them my close-up magic for free. I said, can I do your tables as well? Just to get so I could get the experience of working the tables. And I can remember doing a corporate event and seeing Paul Hancocks, who's a great magician from, yeah, sort of, in fact, he's from your area, isn't he?
Yes, he's just down the road.
He's a lovely bloke and a really good man. In fact, he taught me how to do a double lift properly. Some of my basic card handling skills came from Paul. But I remember meeting him, and I was booked to do my UV show, and he was doing close-up magic. And I was just really so full of respect for somebody who could go up to a table of 10 and command their attention and, you know, and win them over. And so, yeah, and I became friends with him, and he helped me get started with close-up. So I had to get, I needed another string to my bow, because one market was just lessening.
Makes sense.
It's like with this pandemic, actually. I mean, I've all my cruise ship work has just gone. So now I'm just focusing on my products, and my products, I've really, really developed my products to a new, a greater level because of, you know, one door's closed. So another one must open.
It's like that old expression, isn't it? Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So here's a question for you. I want to talk to you about competitions.
Oh, yes.
Purely because, I mean, obviously you won the parlor competition in FISM 2009, which is just, from my point of view, I think that winning FISM, even being invited to perform and compete in FISM, is something that most magicians will never even have the opportunity to do. But outside of that, you won. You know, you didn't just get invited to compete, you won. But, you know, you won so many other competitions as well. It wasn't like somebody came along and said, let's put Mark in FISM, you know, he'll do great. You set the bar by entering so many competitions. So I've got two questions for you. Why did you enter competitions? Was it for a desire to compete? Or was it, like you say, because you thought that it would get you more work? Is there, you know, was there a reason behind that?
First of all, it's definitely not to compete. I do not consider that I'm a competitive person. And actually, when I'm talking to somebody and they say, oh, well, when somebody says, yeah, me, I'm very competitive. Yeah, I have to, the voice in my head goes, oh, you're a dick. Like, I don't like the idea of wanting to be better than somebody else. So that was never my intention to, my thinking behind going into magic competitions was for one purpose only. And that was to improve my standard as a performer. Simply because it's so frightening to put yourself in front of an audience of magicians who are going to judge you and criticize you, and it really motivates you to think that bit more and to work that bit more, so that when you come out there, you know, you're as bulletproof as you can be. It's purely a tool to motivate, and A friend of my son's actually, who's he's one of these guys that considers himself, he's really competitive. And he's tries to convince me that I'm really competitive. He says, you went out there because you wanted to win. You wanted to beat the other guy. I'm like, no, I didn't. I just didn't. I mean, it's not about beating. It's about being the best that I can be. And I'll give you an example. Let's say there was a competition. Let's say I entered a competition and I won it, but my act had not improved at all from 6 months previously. I just went, 6 months later, you do another competition, you win it. Oh, great, there we go. What's the point of that, right? I'd much rather enter a competition and come nowhere, right? But know that I've actually taken the act to a new level for me. That I've taken it, that it might not have been good enough to win, but it's definitely better than where it was. That's much more fulfilling and much more the point of entering a competition.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, I'm not saying I'm free from petty, mean, you know, spirited thoughts, you know, about wanting to be, you know, I do have, you know, sort of stupid kind of like bullshit thinking, but my higher self is just really wants to be better than I am. Yeah.
Which is a great motivation. Yeah. So what advice would you give somebody if they wanted to enter a competition? Let's say that there's somebody watching this, they're new to magic, they want to enter, they want to win FISM. You know, they want to do what you've done. I mean, I know you're not competitive, and I know you, you know, I know you personally, and I know that absolutely is the case. But you've done it. You've done it. What advice would you give somebody that wanted to ultimately be the, you know, win the top competition in the world?
Well, the one thing is, I actually didn't start my whole thing with competitions by thinking, oh, I'll do a competition and I want to eventually win FISM. It sort of built up to that through. So it's a little bit, I think if someone was new to magic, it'd be silly for them to be thinking I should enter for FISM. But I think if a person wants to improve themselves as a magician, competition can be a way to do it. And if you wanted to do that, I would say it's about performance time. The more time you've spent in front of audiences, you know, the better your show's going to be. So, I mean, even before competitions, and even while I was doing competitions, I would perform my act at every single opportunity I could. And I would, you know, I'd invite a group of magicians around, 15 magicians to my home, and, you know, give them some beer and some sandwiches and just say, you know, just to get them to watch my show. A friend of mine, a lovely chap, Christian, I said, oh, can you just come round and invite, like, you know, 10 of your Christian friends round, and we'll have an evening and I'll do a show for you. So I did that. In fact, I did it with quite a few people. And other people, I would say, you know, look, if you can get 10 people into your house, I'll do a show for you. And I would do, you know, sort of 40 minutes of usual stuff, but I would include my competition 10 minutes in there as well. And so, yeah, it's about creating opportunities to put yourself under the pressure of being in front of people. You know, and then afterwards, also, it's about the way that you analyze what went on. So I'm quite careful about the way that I ask people things. I was, you know, in the moment that I picked up that glass, did you believe it was actually empty? You know, or I'll ask very specific questions, you know, or was this moment, which was the strongest moment, this moment or that moment? Or, you know, and so there's so much. I mean, I'll give you an example. A conversation I had with a magician, Gene Anderson, after one of my shows. I would open my show for the competition with quite a mysterious thing with this silver ball. I say, people see things as they gaze into this sphere. And it was all very, you know, the music was all kind of weird. And then in the middle of the show, I would do the thing where people name cards. So I'd say, oh, the gentleman there, would you please name any card? People in the audience would name cards. And what Gene Anderson told me was that the sequence with the cards where I was interacting with the audience, he said, that's the bit when I got who you are. And I thought, yeah, that's who Mark is. I like him, right? And this is a very powerful piece of information. And, you know, this is just an example of by performing and then talking to people afterwards about their experience of the show. He said, because when you came on and you're doing all this kind of, you know, I was thinking, who is it? What's he about? You know, he said, but when I saw you talking to the audience, you know, I thought, yeah, I get who he is. I understand him and I like him. So then I realized, oh. So then I started to change it. So I opened the act with the cards. So I walk on, you know, so many please. So the first few minutes were chatting to the audience and interacting with the audience and building a bond and creating affinity. Now, then they get you and they like you. And then the music can go all weird and people see things as they gaze into the sphere. And yet you can then be all kind of mysterious and they'll go with it because they get you and they like you. So yeah, so that's an example of really just asking for feedback and thinking about it and acting upon it.
That's really great advice. And also with regards to competitions, what's your advice for dealing with nerves? Because I know that you suffer with nerves sometimes despite your unbelievable talent and the fact that, like, okay, I'll give you an example. I've entered competitions, nowhere near the level that you've won at, but I've entered competitions. I've won some, I've won not. Probably the biggest competition I ever entered was the close-up competition at Blackpool, and I walked out and I was so nervous. Like, I don't get nervous very often. My hands were shaking, I was sweating, I couldn't see out my eyes. How do you deal with nerves? What do you have any advice on that?
Well, in a way, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about a moment ago with the more time you've actually performed it, the more times you've put yourself in front of real people performing it, the better your nerves get. I've got like an example, which is not the best example, but I'm going to tell it you anyway, because I don't, have you ever seen a film called The Vanishing?
No, I've heard of it though.
Yeah. Trying to think of the guy. Anyway, basic story is this chap is a science teacher, and he abducts Kiefer Sutherland's wife and buries her alive. Some sick, twisted thing. It's a whole... But he's so meticulous in his planning that before he actually does this abduction, he will knock himself out with chloroform and time how long it takes him to come round again and all this. And he will approach people, practice approaching people to do this abduction, right? But be measuring his heart rate as he's going up to do it. Not actually not doing it, just going through the process, and then he checks his heart rate, right? And he keeps doing it until his heart rate, he does it so much that his heart rate is at a normal rate, you know. So it's a terrible example, but
I think that's a great example.
It's the same kind of thing, you know. It's absolutely terrible. I mean, I'm even scared if I was to just do something for my new neighbours. Like, I'd be, you know, really concerned of messing the thing up and not coming across right. So it never really goes away, and it's not a bad thing. The nerves are essential. I think if you're not nervous, like if you're not a certain amount of nerves, if you're not nervous, you're probably not very good. Like, I think so I've seen people with like a false confidence, you know. I mean, a friend of mine, he's like, oh, it went a bomb, they loved it. And I'm thinking, I think people sometimes insulate themselves from being able to perceive the reality of the situation, and they convince themselves that they're confident and cocky and the audience loved it and everything's cool. And they're living in a sort of self-created illusion, to avoid the painful truth that things are just not that good. So yeah, a certain sensitivity and nerves, it's necessary. I think also, you know, I'm working on a little act at the moment, and even just showing it to my son and to my partner the other day, we my nerves are just there, even just showing it to somebody I know. And there are moments, you know, a point came into my head last night as I was driving my son home after, and I said, you know, if you've got different props that you need to pick up and put down, if you don't know, sometimes you pick up two things at the same time, you know, or you pick up, if you don't know which hand you're going to pick a prop up with, then that trick's not ready. You know, you're not ready to perform that yet. It goes a lot deeper than that. If you don't know the exact grip that you're going to start with, you know, then it's, you know, if you pick it up this way or that way, you can't be, the actual position points on the object and the position points on the hand, it's got to be practiced and figured out in advance. Nerves get lessened when you've analyzed something so thoroughly, you know, you really know exactly where the props are, the orientation of them, and that when you pick that up, you know the exact position points of each finger on which location point on the object, and the sequence of grip changes through operating the thing, you know, and which pocket your pen's in, and you know, everything's just by thinking the thing through so thoroughly and having repeated it thoroughly and repeated it in front of real people, put yourself under the pressure of being in front of real people, that lessens the nerves. Here's another one. This is something this was quite important to me, this one. When you're practicing on your own, you are doing it in the space of the room, and the room has a certain shape. There's a certain limitations to the shape of the room. When you perform in the real world for an audience on stage, the room's going to be much bigger. It's going to be spatially very, very different experience. So I kind of realized this, and when I was practicing for FISM, I knew that the auditorium held 2,000 people. So when I'm practicing, I actually project out into a space that's the size of the space that I'll be performing in. I don't feel like I'm in this room. I feel like I'm in. So it's a sort of a mental expanded mindset, performing. Just look. I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine and helping him with his act. And he could imagine that there was people sitting in the chairs in my living room, but he couldn't imagine any chairs beyond the wall of the living room. So what this is the way I like to think about it, is that the apparent solidity of the physical walls constrain you.
Yeah.
They're sort of like, it's as if they're telling you, you can't project space beyond these walls. So it's a mindset of recognizing that you create space with your own mental anchor points, put it out beyond the constraints of the physical universe. You actually create your own universe. Your own ability to create a universe is greater than the constraints of the physical universe put upon you. I know that's a little bit abstract.
No, it's not. This is really, really valuable advice, really is, absolutely.
Thank you. I must say that is one of that basic idea, which can be applied in so many different ways, is probably one of the most precious. The thing about mental space. Yeah.
One other question about competitions, and I'm going to move on. What made you come up with the act that you eventually won most things with is the golden act, wasn't it? With the think of a card, multiple selection.
Yeah.
And the massive productions and so on and so forth. How did you come up with that? Because every single time I've seen a competition act that's done really well, they've got that thing that you can describe the act in one sentence. And your act can be described and summed up in one sentence. And it is very clear what's happening throughout. Were you looking for a hook, or how did that whole thing come about?
Yeah, it... Well, I think I realized that the people naming a card, you know, you can stand on a big stage and people can name a card and you can interact with them. It was a very powerful way of doing close up in a big way. So I knew that had to be part of it. So I knew that was the strongest thing I could do with cards. And then I years before I even had like the apple, for example, that turns to gold, I was like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to produce an apple and turn it to gold? You know, I was quite astonished that it had not been done. In fact, and then I started thinking, why not? The whole idea of, you know, the Midas thing of everything he touched turned to gold. And, you know, I've heard that expression when people talk about, you know, this successful entrepreneur, everything this person touches turns to gold, you know, is out there as a concept. Why hasn't any magician ever wanted to exploit that as an idea? It's so obvious, really, to go down that. So I was quite lucky that I'd cottoned onto something that other people hadn't thought of. And then, so there's that side of it. And then I had like a key that, you know, occasionally I'll see something and think, well, that looks kind of magical, you know, but I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I just think I just want that. I don't know, one day I think that might be useful to me, and if not, I just like it and I want it around because it gives me a sort of pleasant sort of magical vibe. So yeah, I had the key lying around for a while, and then, you know, I position things in my house like ornaments and things. I thought, that'll be in my peripheral vision while I'm watching TV, or, you know, there's things around to inspire me. So yeah, in answer to your question, it's difficult to put it, to answer it in one way. It just kind of evolved.
Okay, now let's move away from competitions for a minute. I want to talk to you about the other thing that you're probably most well known for at this point, which is creating. You know, you've created so many magic tricks, and I want to talk to you about the process of creating and all the different things that you've done. But I think the first thing is, as of time of recording this, you've just bought out Lucid Coin. Yeah. Myself and Ryland have just given it a rave review. We thought it was amazing. I think it's beautiful. Could I A, ask you to show us the Lucid Coin, and then yeah. B, talk about it a little bit? Would that be okay for a couple of seconds?
Normally, you know, I'd have a bit of music on, but it's a sort of, it's something to use with a Mises coin where you can produce coins like this. So you could do this all day long and just produce them, and there's a vanish like that. Yeah. Yeah. And then you've got like this sort of thing. And obviously, you know, I'm just producing the same coin again and again, releasing the coins into the bucket. But it's a very sort of clean way of doing it. It's good for stage because it's a good. Like, I wanted a large size coin that's very visible.
Beautiful, it really is. And I think the key thing is that a lot of people don't realise there's not any sleight of hand taking place there. The gimmick that you receive with the coin does 99% of the work for you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I heard someone, Saturn Magic, they gave it a review. I haven't heard it from it, but they got that someone told me that he said, he, you know, spent an hour and it took him an hour. And I think that's a fair comment. It's going to take an hour to get the gist of it going. I've got quite a nice finish to it as well, where you come around, produce the last one like that, and then take it and then do this.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Yeah, so I've included that and all the handling, you know, so people can use it in their own way. I think the best way to use it is as a sort of stage or parlour, Miser's Dream.
But it can, having seen the gimmick and watched the download and played with it myself, and something that I actually said in the review of this product is it can be done close up. You know that from there's no pocket space that's taken up, there's no angle problems. In fact, it's just as it's like coin magic in that there's no angles, but it's very easy to do. You walk up to a table corporate and you walk over and you stop doing that for 10 seconds, it's going to grab the attention of the whole table.
It's true that you could do it close up. I made the mistake of looking at some thread about it on the Magic Cafe, and you just see some of the ludicrous things that some idiotic people say. But in terms of angles, yeah, you it's correct that for the Miser's Dream, the angles are pretty much perfect. You can do it all around. That one vanish, the angles for that are a little, you know, you wouldn't do that if you've got people here and here, but that's the only angle sensitive one. And of course, if you were doing this, you couldn't do it with people around there, that production. But for the basic production, yeah, it's pretty angle friendly. Yeah, you could, yeah, that's true, you could do it close up at tables.
And I made that point on the show. I was like, you could walk up to a table, 10 people there, and you know as well as me, when you're doing close-up, one of the key things is to grab people's attention. You know, you start doing that for like 20 seconds. Hey, my name's Craig, I'm a magician, have a look at this, put it in your pocket, have it disappear, bring it back, blow it, it vanishes. You're going to grab people's attention a lot easier than, I'd like you to pick a card right now, please, if you could. You know, it's...
Yeah. Actually, I hadn't thought about it, but you could definitely do it at tables, and you could even have, you know, you could finish with that final load as well. It'd just be the reset from table to table. But if you were just doing the productions of the one without the final load, you could do that, yeah, quite easily.
Hmm. It's a beautiful routine. I mean, you've created so much magic at this point. Through the years, you've created so much stuff and so many things that you've created that are in my act. You've created so much that I think people forget some of the things that you've done. I remember one of the routines that you bought out years ago that I still do to this day is number 37. Where you've got the envelope and it's, you know, it's a perfect opener. You know, it's a perfect opener. And, you know, there's so much that you do.
Yeah, most of my stuff you can do close up and on stage as well. That's the thing with 37. I do that. I've got a release which I'm happy to show you. It's it's not actually, I can't, I was going to show you the packaging, but I think I might not be allowed to do that with Murphy's, but I will show you the trick. It's called Outstanding. You can do this in, use it in lots of different ways. I'll just demonstrate one way. So I point to an envelope in my pocket and I say, inside the envelope, there's a piece of paper. And on the piece of paper, there's a playing card. And a playing card, Craig, will pop into your mind right now. Any card.
Seven of Hearts.
Unbelievable, right? We didn't set this up at all, did we?
No, not at all. Not at all.
No, you could have said any card. There's just one envelope here. There is just one piece of paper in the envelope. And there is just one thing written on the piece of paper. Seven of Hearts.
That is phenomenal.
Thank you.
That is phenomenal. Like, yes. Seriously. That is, yeah. What I love about you, Mark, is you're so humble. You know, you've got all the talent in the world. You've just shown me something which has completely blown me away. And you're like, oh, yeah, thank you. As if it's like nothing. That is amazing right there. That is amazing.
I appreciate that. I mean, I don't want to appear egotistical. It is definitely the best thing I've ever come up with. And it comes with the cards. It can be any card they named. It's that clean every time. But it also comes with blanks that you can, so you don't have to predict, you can predict 52 of anything. And it's just that clean.
It reminds me a little bit of Bang On, other than, yeah, the fact that there's no wallets, there's one pocket. I mean, that is just so ridiculously clean. What you have there is you have the Holy Grail for magicians, which is, I want to have an envelope and I want to be able to open it and show that I've predicted a playing card in there. It's the perfect out. It's the perfect thing to carry around with you. A, from an opener's point of view, I love opening with something like that, an impossible prediction, walking up to the table and say, hey, I'm going to show you something, name a card, boom. So much better than taking a pack of cards out. And then, like I say, I'm assuming it works brilliantly as an out. So if you've got a problem, if you've screwed up a trick, you can go into that. Phenomenal. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, with Bang On, I mean, I like Bang On and I've used it for years and years and years, but it doesn't, with this, the fact you can show the envelope from the very beginning is why this is better than Bang On. And it's also an improvement on Bang On because it can be anything. You can, 52, yeah.
So you could literally have anything predicted. You could, that's so cool.
Yeah, I include all the, everything they need to be able to customize it to be able to, to have anything. It's really 52 of anything. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah. So let me ask you a question. How, from a creativity point of view, and you're such a creative guy, from a creativity point of view, how did you create that? Was that an extension of Bang On? Because obviously you've said earlier on this interview that you always revisit your previous routines and you're always trying to constantly improve. Or was it that it was an entirely new, how does the creative process work when you're making something so outstanding, pun intended?
Yeah, well, I think going back to what I was saying about the apple, you know, I had this idea that I wanted to produce an apple and turn it to gold. And I had that idea for like a few years before I ever had an apple that turned to gold. So it's, I think the key point of creativity is back to that thing that we were talking again, also about the space, you know, being able to imagine, what do I want to see happen? Just realizing that your potential to create matter, energy, space, and time from out of your head is massive. The potential to do that is so much bigger than any of us are ever really aware of. I have little, wouldn't it be great if you could do that, you know, but then don't follow up with, yeah, but that's not going to happen because you can't blah, blah, blah. It's like, I think it'd be great to do this, and just keep it there as a mind movie, as something that one day I'm going to figure out how to do that. It might not be today or tomorrow, or, you know, but it's having that sort of self-belief that, and trusting your own subconscious to process your desires such that when you're out and about doing your daily, that things in the world will pop up and you, that'll help me with this thing, you know. So you, I think your subconscious is always kind of like ticking away and working away. It's like programming your subconscious. So, you know, I just thought it'd be really nice to have an envelope where you have 52 outs from one envelope, or seemingly. And how, so, yeah, well, I mean, how this evolved was, I had a bank night, which was really, and I was into pulling open the envelope. I really liked the idea of, instead of saying, look, there's nothing in there, just pulling it open for stage, you know, that you can do it close up, but I had it with larger, just pull it open. And it's very sort of, yeah, it's just better than, can you see inside? There's nothing there. You know, it's like just boom. And so that's how that started. So I've been doing that for a few years, my version of Bank Night. And then I started to have this idea that the envelopes that don't have the money in, I've got a prediction in. So somebody would, you know, there's no money in here, but there is a piece of paper, name any day of the week or any planet or any color or any, you know. So it's sort of like, it was, wasn't so disappointing. You haven't won. It was like saying, as if you're saying, well, you haven't won, but inside is a piece of paper with the very thing that you get, you know. So you haven't won the money, but you've guessed correctly, or I've made you guess correctly what's written on the piece of paper in the envelope. So that's how this originated. So then, and then I started to, I started to realize how I could get more and more outs out of one envelope. And then I started to, I am not kidding. I have made, 70, 80, maybe more envelopes. I mean, obviously I've made, just to get to the prototype of the correct one that works. The process, it was staggeringly, you know, changing the dimensions and the mechanics of each thing. So, yeah, so, I mean, I had quite a large envelope and I had 12 outs. So then I was looking, have like any birth sign named, and it's in this envelope, you take it out, boom, there it is, and bang. And so I got it very clean down to 12 outs from one envelope. And then I was kept reducing the size of the envelope and increasing the size of the paper. And then I got it just perfect with one. And then I was just literally half asleep thinking about Bang On, and then I made the link with this to Bang On, and I literally got out of bed and just boom, I just suddenly knew how to take it from 12 outs to 52.
That's great.
Yeah,
that is phenomenal. That is so cool. I mean, yeah, I am actually genuinely blown away by that. I want it now. You know, when you see a trick and you kind of think, I want that. I see so much magic doing the review show, so much magic. Just watching that performance has got me more excited than pretty much anything I've seen for the last few months. That is.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Yeah,
it's definitely the best thing. You know, you could do it at tables. It resets instantly. It's reset now. I obviously you wouldn't repeat it with the same table, but I'll do it again for you. You like. It's reset, ready to go now. So there it is. Mm-hmm. Name any playing card, Craig, anything.
My son's favorite card, the King of Hearts.
King of Hearts. 3 points. One envelope. One piece of paper in the envelope. And just one thing written on the piece of paper. King of Hearts.
Wow. You know where else that will work great for? You know that I'm doing a lot of Zoom shows at the moment. I did one just before this interview, which is why I had to come on a bit later. A Zoom show, that's brilliant, because you can have that on screen the whole time. You could say, look, I've got an envelope here. Let's do this. So clean for us. You know, so many people are doing virtual performances at the moment. That would be brilliant for a virtual
performance. Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that. That's... that's it's perfect. That's it. It's perfect for Zoom. It's perfect for close up. It's perfect for stage.
If you can predict, you know, normally when you see something like that, that's card routine. Normally it's exclusively for close up magicians or stage magicians. But you know what? If you can predict anything with that, can you imagine
like, for example, a kid show. Can you imagine going into a kid show where you've got like slightly older kids, like 6, 7, 8 years old? Hey, name any cartoon character from any TV show. I want you to name any cartoon character from any TV show. Boom. You know, wow. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I've played with Makes of Cars, American States, Superheroes is another one. Yeah, similar sort of thing. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
I'm glad you like it, Craig. Thank you.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Here's a question for you. And this is a question I seem to ask everybody that's on this show. And the reason is I'm interviewing so many wonderful, creative, talented people. What's next, like, on your bucket list? Because without being funny, Mark, you have the career that most people would dream of. If I turned around to any magician and said, right, you can end your career having won almost every major championship in the UK, win FISM, be respected as a creator of magic, perform all over the world, cruise liners, big corporate events, close-up stage, they'd be like, yeah, I'm happy. I'm done with that. I mean, you've done it. What's next? What's on the bucket list?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I'm not sure what's happening with the cruise ship. So in a way, I'm kind of like just writing that off. You know, I've been relying on cruise ships for quite a while. And actually, it's been quite good for me to just, you know, taken me out of my comfort zone. And I've started working on my act. In fact, I've been working on an act, not for competitions, but it's just just something I'm just really enjoying. Now, I don't drink alcohol nowadays at all. But it's got like an alcohol theme. It's bottles of wine and red wine and this sort of thing, and red flowers and red silks. And it's just everything's about, in the way that the gold act, everything's gold. With this one, everything's red. And I'm just really enjoying it. Like I've been working on the music and the sound effects to go over it. And I'm just looking forward to performing it. It's just a 10-minute act that's got that sort of, I don't know how to explain it really. I'm not acting drunk or anything, but it's so anyway, that's just something I'm enjoying doing. I've got no great plans for it. If I get back on the cruise ships, it'll be part of my cruise ship act for sure. But also I have been consulting and helping people with their magic, and I actually would like to do that more. So that's something I've been thinking about, working out some sort of when I was about probably 18, 19, there's a magician that some of the older magicians will know. He's passed away now, sadly, but his name was Bobby Bernard. So when I was in Young Magician of the Year, he approached me and said, basically gave me a proposition that if I give him £750, that he would then... I could consult with him like forever. It's like a one-time payment of being able to access him. And anyway, at the time, I didn't really want to do it. But as the years went on, I was probably about, maybe I was 18, 19, maybe 20. But I went to him and I said, I basically offered him £500. I said, because I'm already established. I've already got an act that works. It's not like you're not helping me from scratch, but I would like to be able to phone you up and ask you this and ask you that and consult with you. And so I had that forever, really, that I could just phone him up and ask him things. He's like a very knowledgeable magician that was always there for me. And I've been trying to think of different ways that I could... do something similar, not just similar in the sense that somebody subscribes to something and then I'm then committed to helping them, whether it be on a consultation basis, if they prefer it to be anonymously, like consulting for their TV work or acts for competitions or products or help in coaching, in training, in perfecting an act, or just whatever people need. I just really find that I started to enjoy more and more helping people. I get a real kind of thrill out of it.
one thing I know about you, because obviously we've known each other for years, is you're very passionate about helping people. And despite how talented you are, and I'm going to keep saying it because you are, you have no ego at all, which is rare for magicians, and you're a genuinely nice guy. I think that, you know, if you could come up with some sort of mentorship thing, I think that so many magicians would benefit from that. And one thing that I keep talking about over and over again on this channel is the importance of improving and the importance of actually not just going out there and sucking, you know, but actually making sure you've got somebody who can say to you, look, this is right, this is wrong. You're the perfect. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I'd love to do it. And it's nice that you think I'm, I mean, I think it'd be wrong of me to really accept that without telling you that I do have a dark side, that I'm not, you know, I'm just not, I do have an ego sometimes, you know, I mean, when I was practicing for FISM and I was, you know, imagining that I'm in this auditorium of 2000 people, I can remember like produce the big key and at the end, the music come out and we go, take that, you motherfuckers, you know. Obviously, I'd never say anything like that in an actual performance, but, you know, I do have, you know, I do have an ego. I try and control it. and I also, you know, I have small, mean, petty thoughts and, you know, so, you know, but it's just trying to not be driven by them.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a couple of other questions for you, actually. And one, what I want to pick up on one thing that you've said throughout this interview. You've talked about the music and music that you use in your act. And that's one thing I've noticed watching. I've seen you perform live with the UV act and the Golden act and a lot of other things. And one thing that always strikes me is your music choices are just on point. And I think a lot of the time these days, people don't think about music.
Yeah.
You know, especially somebody who's doing close up that's going onto stage, they think about the tricks they're going to do, but they don't think about music. But music can really heighten the performance so much. Have you got any advice on picking music and incorporating music into an act?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that I think is a mistake is to use a piece of music that is very, very well known. So I would never do that. Because people have too many inbuilt associations with that sound, and it's just going to affect the way they're going to perceive what they're looking at. So, yeah, I would say don't use anything that's really well known. Mostly, I would not use anything that's got lyrics. There are exceptions to that, but generally, I think you don't want something that's got lyrics. And in a similar way that I was talking about, when you want something to create something, you imagine it and then trust your subconscious to deliver the thing, to alert you to information in the world that will, you know, it's a similar thing with the music. I will practice magic to music, even though I'll just sort of have it on in the background. And it might not be the music I'm going to use, but if you keep playing with, you know, you practice, you've forgotten about the music. You're just sort of, you're just trusting that the music will arrive, I guess, as in the same way that the solution to the problem that you know, if you approach it in the right way, the problem to the solution will arrive. It's similar. The music will arrive. I just put atmospheric music on and I practice and at somebody, you know, I'll practice, let's say a 30-second or a 1-minute sequence over and over and over, and I'll have 40 minutes of atmospheric music on. And there'll come a point where I'm like, oh, all of a sudden, oh, that's weird how that just went so perfectly with the music. Where was that? Oh, let's have a look. Oh, it was 33 minutes and 27 seconds. So I'll make a note of every time there seems to be like a synergy of action and sound that that really goes well together. Yeah, and then I just collect bits. I mean, and recently, you know, with Spotify, I mean, I've just been really getting into using Spotify. And the way I found the music for my part of my show that I described earlier was that I just made a little playlist. It's so easy to make a little playlist of like five or six tunes that might work. and then just have that playlist playing randomly while I'm practicing the moment. And then it just becomes, you know, there was one that was a little bit, it was quite nice, but it was very, I don't know how to explain it really. It was just very safe. And then there was another one that was really kind of crazy, and it was making me kind of be like wacky, you know, but it was just not, that wasn't, it was too much for me, but I wanted something in between that would allow my a certain character to evolve out of it. And it just became clear that which the right piece of me, just through letting this playlist go over and over as I was practicing the sequence. And then you know, like last night my son was with me, I ran through the whole sequence, and there was just one moment where we just need a sound effect in that moment. It's where a white liquid, take a red silk and you go like this, and the silk vanishes and the white liquid turns into red liquid. And it just needed a, you know, like, so about 1 o'clock in the morning last night, he's on the computer, we find the sound like a, like that, and just put it, you know, just overlay it on the track. I really like adding little sound effects in. And also I think sometimes when people try and find music, you know, they'll find maybe 5 minute piece or an 8 minute piece. And I think that, well, for me, it doesn't work for me. For me, what I find is I like to find 30 seconds or a minute. It's very rare that there'll be more than 2 minutes of the same piece of music. I like little sections and bolt them together. So yeah, I don't know if that's any help.
No, it is. It really is. That's real help. A couple of questions before we finish. When is Outstanding out?
I don't know. I'm probably gonna. Ooh, I don't. Yeah, actually, I didn't. I need to. I'm not sure, actually. It'll be within the next month.
So one last question, Mark. You know, you've talked about this act that you're developing, which sounds amazing. Would you ever enter another competition again?
I'm not sure. Never say never, I guess.
Never say no. I tell you, if you did enter another competition again, I wouldn't want to be the guy that's competing against you, put it that way. Not a chance. But I can tell that you're very focused at the moment on the creating, and you're very focused on, you know, mentoring and that side of things. I can see that's something you're very passionate about. When Outstanding comes out, have you got other ideas that you're going to be working on moving forward?
Well, I've got one that I had planned to follow Outstanding, that I really like it, but the problem is it's not a socially distancing trick. It's a trick where you need to hand somebody something and interaction. So I think I might develop it, but not release it until we're in a situation where we can interact with people directly. So I'm thinking about going back.
Okay. Yeah. And then kind of just waiting for the world to go back to normal and then pushing it out there. Yeah.
I think it might get released and just not see the light of day, really, not get the exposure that I think it deserves. Yeah.
Which would be a shame. Awesome. Well, you know what, Mark? It has been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I think that the advice that you've given us is absolutely, again, pardon the pun, golden. The advice has been absolutely amazing. It really has. And where can people find you? You know, I mean, obviously, your products are available worldwide, but do you have your own magic shop where people can go to? And I can put the web link on the screen as we're talking.
Yeah. Well, just at the moment, the shop's just on my website, which is just markoberon.co.uk.
Okay. And if you ever go down the route of doing more mentorship stuff, would that be the place where that would be accessible?
Yeah, I think so. I'm thinking about separating out the, you know, my performance side with, you know, because I've got, yeah, the like the UV show and the cruise ship show and the products are just completely different markets, different people. So I really need three different websites.
I can see that actually. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what?
wherever people find you, you are an amazing performer, an amazing creator, and a wonderful person. So thank you so much one more time for being on the show. You're amazing.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Craig.
And guys, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. I'm going to be back tomorrow with another review show with Rye, and we got stuff coming up every single day this week. So subscribe to the channel, and we'll see you again. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel,
Magic TV,
which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.